Live and local, we are Acadiana's sports station. 103.7 The Game. KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parch III and Cody Schutz talk sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. Raging Cajun legend Brian Mitchell.
My dream was always to play in the NFL, so having an opportunity was the main thing I needed.
LSU College World Series hero Warren Morris.
I don't get tired of talking about it. You know, if people remember me for that home run and winning that championship, I think that's great.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Good morning, Acadiana. This is Raymond Parch III, and this is RP3 and Company right here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing, also simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Network. One of the new sports channels for all you sports fans out there. If you haven't checked it out, make sure to go check out the Stadium Network. We're broadcast right there on it. Plus, it has other original programming. We've got a jam-packed show for you today. Got a lot to get to. We will have, later on the show, our good friend Andrew Juge from the Saints Happy Hour podcast. He will be joining us, breaking down the New Orleans Saints draft, his thoughts from his perspective. Did the Saints have a good draft? Did they win the draft, like some people are saying? What did he think about their moves and the players that they selected? That'll be in the third hour. Also leading off the third hour, our good friend Nick Suss, former guest host here on 103.7 The Game. He now covers the Ole Miss Rebels for the Clarion Ledger there in Jackson, Mississippi. He's going to come on and give us a little bit of a preview of the Ole Miss at LSU baseball series, key series for the SEC West standings and the SEC overall standings this weekend at Alex Box Stadium. All three games can be heard live right here on 103.7 The Game. Nick will join us to help us preview that. And then in the second hour, live in studio, the head coach of the undefeated state championship winning Notre Dame Lady Pio's softball team. They just brought back the hardware, the Division III championship there in Sulphur last weekend. The head coach, Del Siri, will be joining us live in studio. Plus, we'll talk NBA playoffs, UL baseball, plus much, much more. But we're going to lead off the day talking about the story that just keeps on giving. Will Wade. Yesterday it broke that a video aired at an NCAA trial that connects LSU's Will Wade, the embattled and recently reinstated head men's basketball coach, to a $300,000 deal to Naz Reid, the freshman sensation, all SEC freshman who's declared for the NBA draft. As Amy just reported for NOLA.com, it took only a week for names associated with LSU to get brought up in the latest NCAA corruption trial, as a video aired on Monday showed a former Arizona assistant discussing Will Wade specifically and a $300,000 bid for Naz Reid. Former Arizona assistant coach Emmanuel Book Richardson is heard in the video discussing Wade's reported offer for Reid, who at the time was a five-star prospect coming out of high school. Richardson quoted Wade as saying, "Look, there's a deal in place. I got $300,000 for him." Richardson then says, "I said, listen, curse word, give me half that and I'll make sure he goes there." Now, to be clear, this is not Will Wade on the videotape. This is a former Arizona assistant coach talking about a discussion that was had between him and Will Wade on a videotape. So let's be clear there. According to the video, Wade wanted to hire Richardson as an assistant at LSU. On August 18th, 2017, Reed announced that he was down to two schools in his recruitment, LSU and Arizona. Wade visited Reed less than a month later on September 11th, 2017, and Reed verbally committed on September 12th per 247 Sports. Reed signed during the early signing period on November 13th of that same year. Reed earned all freshman honors this past year, averaging nearly 14 points, 7 rebounds, and about 27 minutes per game. Richardson, meanwhile, had pleaded guilty in January to one felony count of conspiracy to commit bribery after he was accused of accepting $20,000 in bribes to make sure Arizona players end up with certain managers and financial advisors. His sentencing is scheduled for May. Now remember, federal district judge Edgardo Ramos ruled earlier this month that the testimony from both Wade and Arizona head coach Sean Miller, and if everyone thinks that the story is just about Will Wade here in the Pelican State, I can assure you, out west, Sean Miller's getting the same treatment. Okay? There's just more of an interest about Will Wade here in the state of Louisiana. Out west, California, Arizona, they're talking about Sean Miller, and they're talking about him a lot. And they have been for the last year. But Judge Ramos, remember, ruled earlier this month that the testimony from either Miller or Wade was irrelevant to the criminal case. This news of what happened in the courtroom comes just 2 weeks after Wade was reinstated after a 37-day suspension and had his contract amended. Remember, he agreed, him and his new attorney, which deals with the NCAA and deals with NCAA violations, he changed his attorney. They met with the university on that Friday. By Sunday, he was reinstated. We come to find out later that the terms of him being reinstated was not only did he give up $250,000 bonus from the team winning the SEC regular season title and reaching the Sweet 16, he also allowed amendments to his contract saying that if he committed NCAA Level 1 or Level 2 infractions or was indicted in a state or federal court are now fireable offenses. So Wade agreed to this. Remember, way back on March 7th, media reports detailed a wiretap conversation between Wade and former Adidas consultant Christian Dawkins. That conversation, recorded by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, includes Wade openly speaking about a quote-unquote strong-ass offer he made in the recruitment of current LSU guard Javonte Smart. Wade's suspension began on March 8th, but was not associated with the actual information in the report first broke by Yahoo. Remember, he got suspended because he refused to talk to his employers based on the advice of his then attorney. He changed attorneys. And I come back to this, and we talked about this on the show. The language that Joe Oliva used in his statement following the reinstatement of Will Wade caught my attention, and it should have caught yours. Remember, this is what Joe Oliva wrote. Quote, Coach Wade's explanations and clarifications offered during the meeting, absent actual evidence of misconduct, satisfy his contractual obligation to LSU. I said it on the show then, and I'll say it again. They did not have the evidence proof to fire Will Wade. So instead, they had him sacrifice his bonus, and they had him amend his contract. So if any of this other stuff happens in the future, that they could fire him, and they made it easier to fire him. This was not a vote of confidence from the university. LSU did comment, was aware of the situation about Richardson, who, according to the video, says that Wade wanted to hire him as an assistant at LSU. Now, that happens all the time, by the way. People associated with players, either their coach or a quote-unquote family friend, AAU coach. That happens every time, just not at LSU, but this has happened for generations throughout college basketball, where people associated with a top prospect all of a sudden get a job at the university the said prospect is going to. This is nothing new, okay? It just isn't. Do we have proof that Will Wade wanted to hire Richardson as an assistant coach? No. It's Richardson's word. And once again, this man is now a convicted felon. Can we believe what he says? No. I need proof. It can't just be a he said kind of situation. LSU is aware of the situation, but declined to comment, only stating this, quote, "We are continuing to monitor the situation due to the fluid nature of this matter," which I love. Fluid nature of this matter. LSU will refrain from commenting until further notice, said Jason Drody, LSU's interim vice president for strategic communications. Well, that's a mouthful. I wonder, is he able to get that title on a business card? I have questions. Side note. Once again, undercover video revealed on Monday showed that Book Richardson talking about LSU coach Will Wade approaching him with an informal inquiry about luring Book away from Arizona to coach with at LSU. This was not a statement in court. This is an undercover video that was played in court. Did Book Richardson know that he was being videotaped? We don't know. You would assume he didn't. So once again, while this should be a time of celebration with the new athletic director, Scott Woodward coming home, the Baton Rouge boy coming back home, the baseball team ranked in the top 10, the softball team ranked in the top 10, the gymnastics team just finishing as national runner-up. Recruiting, LSU football recruiting is now number one for the 2020 class. And yet there's Will Wade. He in his situation and all the things surrounding him is like a rash that won't go away. No matter how many shots you go to the doctor's office to get rid of it, it just won't go away. His name keeps coming out of the mouths of convicted felons. Once again, the head coach at LSU for the men's basketball team, his name keeps being mentioned by people who are going to prison. The company you keep matters. I've said it over and over again. Will this matter? Will this affect Will Wade's job at LSU? Will this prompt an NCAA investigation? Who knows? Probably not. But we'll see. But once again, when there's so many good things going on at LSU, the head basketball coach for the men's hoops team there at LSU has people that are convicted felons dropping his name on recordings. again. We head up to a break. You're listening to RP3 and Company right here on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company right here on 103.7 The Game. I'm your host, Raymond Parch III, and we're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. Also simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Network. A great network for all things sports-related. Sports talk, sports games. Plus, you get to see my big, bald mug on the television. Why not check out the Stadium Network? Give us a call today. I'd like to hear what the people out there across Acadiana have to say about the Will Wade situation. Give us a call on the ARCO Equipment Hotline, 337-706-0111. Once again, that's 337-706-0111. Once again, Will Wade is dominating the news cycle, and there's no games to be played. A third inference of LSU coach Will Wade attempting to pay for a player in recruiting emerged in federal court yesterday, on Monday. In a recorded conversation, former Arizona assistant coach Emmanuel Book Richardson said that Wade told him in relation to Tiger star freshman Naz Reid, "Look, there's a deal in place. I got $300,000 for him." So Richardson is saying that Wade told him that if they were able to deliver, that he was able to get Naz Reid, that he essentially had $300,000 for him and his family or his handlers or whoever it may be. According to the recording, Richardson further says he told Wade in response, quote, "Give me half and I'll make sure the kid goes there." So, let's focus in on that real quick. So, this information that we're hearing via a recording in a courtroom comes from a gentleman who was okay with getting paid $150,000 under the table to deliver a prospect to a coach. So, that begs the question. Can you trust anything this person says? And that's the tricky thing, right? When it comes to anything that comes with corruption, whistleblower, corruption, anything like that, is usually the person that brings the shady stuff to light is shady themselves, right? So how can you believe them? That's the perplexing thing here. Once again, but this is just the latest. This is now the third quote-unquote recording that's been involved with a criminal case, was been involved with some type of investigation by the federal government where Will Wade's name is mentioned or there's audio of him. That's a bad look. When you're a basketball coach or a coach of any sport, you probably want to try to strive to have your name not mentioned in federal corruption trials or have wiretap conversations about you making quote-unquote strong-ass offers. That probably should be a goal. Winning a title of some sort, regular season, tournament title, making a run in the NCAA tournament, recruiting top prospects, and then also in that top five should be not having your name mentioned in corruption trials. But this is the third time now. This is the third time. remember, a transcript of a wiretap emerged in the first federal basketball corruption trial back in October of Wade discussing a deal for prospect Balza Koparifaka, who ended up at Florida State. In a transcript read in court by a defense attorney, Wade announces, quote, he's shutting his office door and says, quote, unquote, I can get you what you need. The defense attorney clarified, meaning money, and to reference what Wade said. Then in March, Yahoo Sports reported that Wade discussed on FBI wiretaps making a strong-ass offer for recruit Javonte Smart. Wade expounded on that offer, saying, quote, it was tilted towards taking care of the mom, taking care of the kid. Like, it was tilted towards that. Now I know for a fact, didn't explain everything to the mom. I know now he didn't get enough of the piece of the pie in that deal. And now, this. Three instances. We have the reading of a transcript of a wiretap of Wade talking about the recruitment of a top prospect who ended up going to Florida State. That was a conversation from that transcript of a wiretap between Will Wade and Christian Dawkins. Then the second incident is the audio, the FBI wiretap of a conversation, once again, between Wade and Christian Dawkins, a low-level middleman between sneaker executives and recruits, and a wannabe agent. Boom. And now we have this. A video conversation. A former Arizona assistant coach making claims in a secretly recorded video conversation concerning Naz Reid. So what do we make of this? What can be made of this? Once again, the NCAA is not investigating, or at least we're not privy to them investigating. So far, this is just federal trials. These are FBI investigations that LSU has been privy to. But that's it. Will the NCAA step in? Will LSU and their new leader of the athletic department, Scott Woodward, make some sort of a statement here? Or take some type of action. I don't know. We'll see. But it's not a good look. Welcome back to RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game. I'm your host, Raymond Parch III. And we're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. Simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Network. We've led off the show with the Will Wade news that broke yesterday. So it's time to switch over to the Diamond and talk a little Raging Cajuns baseball. That was Tony Robichaux, longtime head coach of the Raging Cajuns, talking about his team's struggles after being swept over the weekend. The Raging Cajuns now are 20-27 overall, 8-13 in conference play. We've talked about it on this show before. They're not going to be doing anything. They're not making a regional or any of that stuff unless they make a run here towards the end of the season and make a run at the conference tournament. They need to win the conference tournament. They're 7 games under .500. They got a tough 3-game series this weekend in Conway, South Carolina, when they play on perennial power Coastal Carolina. Remember, Coastal Carolina was the team that won the national championship a few years ago. After that 3-game set at Coastal Carolina, they'll come back home for a 3-game stand versus Georgia State and then wrap up the season with a 3-game stand at ULM before the Sun Belt Conference Tournament back in Conway, South Carolina at the end of May. And during his press conference yesterday at UL, he discussed the dreaded 3-run rule, which has been kind of a mantra of Tony's for quite a long time. Got to avoid the three-run inning. Got to avoid the three-run inning. And this team has been able to hit fairly well. But then they just blow leads. Takes this past weekend against Texas State. Now, against Texas State in the Sunday game, they gave up five runs right off the bat. Boom. Put themselves in a hole. Then they gave up another two in the fourth inning, another two in the sixth inning. They tried to rally by scoring, plating four in the bottom of the seventh, but it wasn't enough as they lost 10-8. But once again, three-run innings. You start off a game giving up five runs in the first. You're not going to win many of those games. You're just not. Look at Saturday. They avoided the dreaded three-run inning, but they still lost 3-2. Because they're giving up runs in bunches. Two runs in the second. They tied it back up in the bottom of the second on the Saturday game, but then they gave up another run. And then there was Friday's game. The 13-9 loss to start off the weekend. They gave up nine runs in one inning. Nine. This is a team that has some talent on it. They do have talent. Handsome Monica has double-digit home runs. Hayden Cantrell can hit the ball well. Brennan Breaux, the former STM star that started off his career at LSU, has had some moments. Todd Lott has played well. But Tony said it best during yesterday's press conference, that they've been playing against themselves.
You know, we had another tough weekend. Played another good team, but we also are playing against ourselves right now too. So, you know, we've got to do a better job there. This week we'll have two good days to practice without having a midweek game. We'll try to, you know, throw some of these young arms, put them in some drills and things that we like doing on Tuesday and Wednesday.
They've been hurting themselves. Errors, bad pitching, giving up multiple runs. UL has been so close to being seven games over 500 instead of seven games under 500 this year. The difference is not that much. If you look at their games, the difference is not that much. They've had a lot of games that they've blown late. Bullpen has betrayed them. The pitching has, when the hitting's been on, the pitching hasn't been on. When the pitching has been good, the hitting's not been there. There's not that big of a difference between this team being a good baseball team and being a team that's seven games under 500. But Tony had some tough love for his bullpen, where he talked about yesterday at his weekly press conference that he feels pretty good about where the hitters are, but that bullpen, not so much.
I feel good where our hitters are at. We do have to do one thing, I think, a little better when we get close. We've got to get that last critical hit to go ahead or to tie the game, one of the two. We get very close, and then we can't pull ahead. On the other hand, the pitchers have the bullpen and the pitchers have really sucked the life out of our hitters, because they're always constantly coming from behind. And we haven't been a good come-from-behind team. We can come up and catch you and get close, but then we can't crawl over that last critical hit.
He's basically saying that his team is talented, but not talented enough to overcome like a five-run spot, which no team is. That's just not a UL Raging Cajuns issue. That's a issue, period, for any team. LSU, Arizona, Mississippi State, it doesn't matter. You can't have your team constantly trying to dig itself out of a hole. Tony, who's known for his pitching, his coaching, his development of pitchers, talked about just how important good pitching is to be a successful college baseball team.
Pitching's like cash, man. You can fake like you got it, but eventually you're gonna have to put up or shut up. And that's the one thing that's hurt us. You know, people used to holler all the time, you know, we pitch. Robichaux doesn't recruit hitters because he pitches when I don't even recruit anybody. I mean, my recruiting coordinators recruit everybody. But over time, you know, so now you get a little sneak peek at what happens when you don't pitch. So I think everybody will understand the importance of going back to pitching, because if you don't pitch, I mean, even at the big league level, you look at the teams that are struggling, a lot of them starting pitching.
That was a 42-second answer of, see, I told you.
Yeah,
boy. That was 42 seconds of, I told you.
Oh, yeah. Y'all complained about how I put an emphasis on pitching, huh? Well, here you go.
This is how you end up with 8 Rocky movies.
He also talked yesterday at his weekly presser about Gunnar Leger and how the former All-American candidate and guy that appeared to be drafted early in the Major League Baseball draft before injuries kind of derailed him and he had to miss all of last year, how he's not been able to take that role that they were hoping for, and just the status of Gunnar Leger.
He's a guy that pushes himself hard, and I think it, what he went through with the two surgeries, the first one's probably, I say, easy in the realm of, you know, some type of Tommy John, but then when you have the second one, you know, with the leg, I think you add all that up. I think, and then you add him up, right? He's a guy that he wants to be in. He wants to be in the fire. He wants to carry his team. That's why he came to us and said, "Hey, let me close, because right now I see that, you know, I'm pushing myself too hard. So let me back up. If I can only give you 2 innings a weekend, why do that as a starter? Let me get in there and close for you." And then so we put him in at closer, and then from there, you know, I think he came back and we all talked it out a little bit, and he felt that, you know what, man, I pushed myself so hard, you know, so fast, that I think it's just taxing on me. And so I think I need to back up a little bit. So you have to do what's in a kid's best interest. He's very mature. We've always allowed him to make, not just him, any of the players I've had throughout the years that have been mature enough, not some freshman, to be able to make decisions on how they feel and what they need to do to be good. He potentially has a career after this too, but if he's not careful, he could potentially hurt that too. He's not backing out to save himself for pro ball. He's pulled back because for his safety, for his own body.
Pulled back because of his own safety and his own body. Gunnar not being healthy and not being able to be the ace of the staff has played a huge role this year for this team. You don't want to put that on his shoulders, obviously, because the young man's battling back from injury, but him not being able to be the ace and the anchor of that staff has played a huge role. It's had a domino effect, and that's not being critical of Gunnar. He's not quite right, and he's not quite the pitcher that he was before he got injured. And sometimes these injuries take longer than we'd like them to, right? We always expect these kids and these athletes to bounce back quickly. Well, sometimes that's just not how it works. Sometimes it takes a couple of years before they return to form. I mean, look at the NBA as a comparison. Paul George suffered that gruesome injury. He just now returned back to form this year. And that injury occurred, what, 3 years ago? So it still takes you a while, okay? And that's what I think is going on with Gunnar. But UL has to dust themselves off. They can't sit there and focus on the negative. Coach Robe's not going to let them do that. They got to gear up for a series this weekend over in Conway against Coastal Carolina. This is what Coach Robe had to say on Coastal Carolina.
Well, they, you know, they have a, you know, sometimes it's like us, you know, we, you know, for 13, 14 years, we were either first or second in the league in pitching because we got this kind of this label that we can pitch. And so for years, we've kind of struggled as hitters from time to time. They've had a big label that they can hit, and I think they can hit. And they in a ballpark that is conducive for run production. Their pitchers are struggling a little bit. They you know, they don't always hold people down, but you can counteract that with that kind of scoring. What you got to watch out for is the higher you go up, though, into postseason play, the regional, the super regional, scoring's going to always come down.
It's Tony Robichaux. Giving great answers, as always. You can always count on Rope. He doesn't sugarcoat anything. I love the line. The bullpen's just sucked the life out of his hitters.
Pitching's like cash.
Pitching's like cash. I do love the 42 second response to, hey, this is why I recruit pitching. Essentially, we can find guys that can hit. That's easy. Pitching, not so much.
Here's your little taste of what it's like when the pitching's not so good.
As of right now, though, the Raging Cajuns, it is serious. We talk about them making a run in the conference tournament, Cody. They have to finish strong here just to make it to the conference tournament. That's something I don't think anyone was expecting to state this year. So we'll see. They have some work to do if they want to make it to postseason, even their own conference tournament there in Conway, South Carolina. So when we come back, we'll talk more sports. What is this, a sports talk show? Yes, it is. Right here on RP3 and Company on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company. I am your host, Raymond Hotch III. This is 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live on the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. Simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Network, your new sports network for all things sports, including
24-hour sports network.
I'm sorry?
24-hour sports
24
network.
Hours of sports. And bonus, you get to see this beautiful mug on television.
Right. There's also local content on Stadium Network as well.
You're welcome, ladies.
Feel like now is a good time to bring up last night. I told you yesterday we had our season opener for the PC Rec Cubbies. The T-ball team taking the field last night. And Raymond, may
First
I
of all,
just...
big up on the name.
Yeah.
Congratulations
thank you.
On
thank
that.
You, sir. May I just pat myself as the manager of the PC Rec T-Ball Cubbies. We crushed it last night, Raymond. We absolutely crushed it. I had one kid that I had to stop. He came up to bat. You only play two innings, right?
Okay.
He came up to bat, and he can hit. He's left-handed. He's one of those that you can see it in when he throws the ball. He actually reaches back and throws it. It's not like a weird kid. Like,
and this is T-Ball?
Yeah, four, five, and six. That's how it is. Okay. Four, five, and six.
All right, T-ball. And you only played the two innings. I
right.
remember T-ball going longer for some reason.
It feels like it goes long. Two innings, you're all right.
Hey, T-ball feels like
you're all right.
It feels like.
Okay. But there's a couple of kids on the team that really, that you can tell they have more control over their body at 6 years old than some of the other kids.
Okay.
And there's this one kid, and he can really hit. He can hit well. He's left-handed. He got up there for his first at-bat yesterday. And, I mean, he was squeezing that bat so tight. And he was staring at his front foot. And he picked his front foot up off the ground so slow. And then stepped forward so slow. And then went just like he was thinking about everything so much. And I stopped him because he missed the ball on the swing. I was like, dude, I grabbed him by the bill of his helmet. And I was like, hey, man, and I know this kid. He's like best friends with Kaysen. And I looked at him and I was like, dude.
He missed the ball.
I was like, you are trying way too hard. It was that moment to where you play better when you're having fun. I was like, you don't look like you're having fun right now. And like game face, so serious. And so, you know, you get him to loosen up a little bit, and then he steps back in there, and, I mean, he hits the ball farther than any kid off a tee I've ever seen in my entire life. And it's not really that far. But, I mean, it was just one of those experiences. It's interesting to watch at any level a kid pressing, basically, in T-ball. He was pressing and was struggling. And then you get up there and you tell, just cut loose a little bit. Just do what you know how to do. And it was interesting to watch him smile and then hit the ball really far.
I have questions.
Okay.
Do you have the orange mesh fence that goes across the, that cuts the outfield?
We only play in the outfield. Home plate sits, it's a big high school size field.
Okay.
So home plate sits in the dirt kind of behind where shortstop would be. And then the rest of the field goes out that way.
Okay. Okay.
If that makes, so the infield isn't even used.
I got you. Yeah. So you had to give this young man some coaching, some.
This is the third time around. This is Kaysen's last year at T-ball, and I've coached all three of his T-ball years. And this kid has been on the team with, they're like best friends in school, so okay. They sign up together. So like, me and this kid have a good relationship type of thing. So I can talk to him a little different than I can talk to maybe a kid that I'm just now meeting this summer, maybe.
I got you. A little bit more comfortable. I like your approach, though. It's a tough love approach. I like that.
Okay. Well, but that's what he responds to. And his dad tells me the same thing. Like, he wants to be so good that you got to challenge him even at 6 years old. It's weird. I know it sounds
so
weird.
So I have a question for you then.
Okay.
You've been doing this. This is now you're going to be your third season coaching?
Correct.
Okay. How do you deal with parents? Because I know you've had interaction somehow, some way, or is it too small? They're too small yet.
They're pretty chill, but I haven't had a problem, to be honest. No, because I'm pretty straightforward with. I make sure to get on a text message relationship with all my parents as well.
Okay.
On the first practice, I try to talk to everybody. Hey, it's cool, if we just text back, because that's just easier than a phone call, And so I try to make a good relationship with them. I've never had any major issues or anything like that. But then I also think that umpiring for so long, I think if and when those issues may start arising, that I'll be able to handle them better than most people because of umpiring. Nobody yells.
Well, look,
no parents yell more at an umpire than anything else.
I feel like this is a challenge to me. I feel like this is a challenge to our listeners that you're so chill with being such a laid-back umpire and you're so chill with being a T-ball coach that I feel like we need to bring some Happy Gilmore heckling to the table and target you in particular in the stands and just go and me and like World Famous and get a couple other people from the station and we just go and sit in the stands and just berate you and your team.
Good luck with that. The Cubbies
hey, Skipper,
are
the you're terrible.
The Cubbies
go back
are
to your other job. You're not good at that either, are you?
We're unrattleable. You can't get to us.
That's going to do it for the first hour of RP3 and Company here on 103.7 Game. Coming up in the second hour, we'll have Dale Sierra from Notre Dame, undefeated season in the books, state championship. He'll be live in studio at 7:32. So tune in for that right here on 103.7 The Game.
Live and local on Acadiana's number one sports station, 103.7 The Game. It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parks III and Cody Schutz talk sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. Pro Football Hall of Famer Ricky Jackson.
I tell you what, man, I was out playing basketball, and a lot of guys came and told me Saints drafted you, and they're looking for you. I had forgot all about the draft.
UFC superstar Dustin the Diamond Poirier.
It means everything to me. Lafayette, Louisiana. I was born and raised. I'm a Cajun. I love it. I can't wait to walk through the airport with that dog.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Now in some way, shape the accept.
You don't get it. I will wait. I will wait for you.
I will wait for you.
Maybe not much longer.
Oh, man. Second hour, RP3.
You gotta love the Mumford. You gotta love Mumford and Sons. LSU basketball fans, who knew? The actual song is I Will Wait for You, but I Will Wade for You.
I saw them in funnier. Dallas, Texas, by the way.
I am jealous.
At the House of Blues.
That is even better. Wow.
Right before they blew up.
And that seems like a venue, a Mumford & Sons venue to a House of Blues.
It was good. Standing room only. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Shout out to them. LSU Hoops fans. Or at least Will Wade fans. Not really.
Oh, it's been. Yeah, look, you have to give it up to Will Wade. He at least keeps things interesting. You're listening to RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. Also, simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Network, 24-hour sports network.
I can keep it interesting. I mean, they hire me. I'll keep you interested all day long.
Go back. You're a diehard LSU fan. We know this.
Mm-hmm. Established. Established 1990.
Established 1990. Did you think when he got hired that just in a matter of 2 years, this is what's occurred with Will Wade as the head coach of LSU? Kind of unremarkable first season at the helm. The highlight being the fact that he tried to take part in an 8 Mile-like rap battle with Bob Marlin in the NIT when he acted, let's be honest, like a child, and called the timeout and threw shade and you know, took his chance to puff up his chest against a veteran coach. Okay,
your 30-somethings were showing.
Yeah,
that's all that was. I mean, that's just
yeah. It's just like, all right, young man. All right, young buck. Yeah. I got you. And then they got crushed by Utah in the next round of the NIT. So,
and like I said about that whole situation, if it would have been any other, you know, if he'd have done that to Florida, then, you know, the whole state is like, hell yeah, go get him. But it's like, come on, coach. Where no.
You're picking on the Raging Cajuns.
Know where you're really? At type of thing. But anyway, that is neither here nor there.
Yeah, okay.
We have bigger fish to fry now.
Yeah. So that was that. And I was like, well, damn, look at this.
You want to know what I thought about Will Wade when they first hired him? My initial...
Your initial reaction was like, all the other VCU former coaches haven't worked out anywhere, so but LSU thinks this guy's going to change the fortunes.
Okay. My initial reaction, like the rip the Band-Aid off, wow. I was like, who is this guy? Who is this guy, and why are we hiring? Why have I never heard of him? Da-da-da, listen, that. If you remember, I believe Musselman was a big... talking point during that hiring process.
A lot of people would have liked him, yeah.
I think I would have. That's probably where I was leaning as well. They bring Will Wade in, and my initial was, who is this guy? Never heard of him. He's young, blah, blah, blah. And then more and more you hear people talk about it. And, of course, they're going to prop up the new hire on a pedestal and everything to try to make – and that's fine. That's fair. They kind of turned me into looking at almost like, could this guy be the next – you know, nobody's going to be the next Brad Stevens, but could he be in that vein? Could he be a young guy that – can somehow also be a leader of men as well. And for a minute there, you kind of thought that. You kind of thought it. And then you realize that no matter how much talent Will Wade has, maybe, just maybe, he, I don't know if arrogant is the word, but a little too safe, a little too comfortable, maybe, in what dealings that he may or may not be involved in. You know what I mean here with the money and whatever else have you with these kids and making deals.
There was talk about him when it came to recruiting when he was at VCU, before he was even hired at LSU. Okay, there were rumblings about that. Now, let's have a come to baby Jesus kind of moment here. If you think that your team doesn't recruit and doesn't do things that maybe take place in a gray area when it comes to recruiting, whether it's for basketball or for football, then you're huffing paint thinner because you're not living in reality.
Right.
Okay? You're just not. College athletics is a billion-dollar industry. Anytime there's a billion-dollar industry, there's going to be shady characters involved in that process. I don't care if you're a Fortune 500 company or if you're an athletic department at a university. There's always going to be people involved that are going to be doing things the wrong way. Period. There's always going to be people out there trying to do things the wrong way, associating themselves with anything that deals with money, period. So let's just get that out of the table. Okay?
Am I allowed to have the take? And yeah, I guess my LSU fan will show a little bit here, but I kind of feel this way all the way around. Don't get caught.
Yeah.
Is that an acceptable take on this situation? Probably not. But from a fan perspective, someone who, myself, I have no bearing on college athletics whatsoever, 0%.
Fans don't care.
And that's kind of where I know. And maybe I should care. And maybe I should. That's my problem. That's why I'm putting it on me, because this is how I feel. I don't want to call out anyone else.
But then you get into the argument, though, is from a moral standpoint, you'd like there not to be cheating.
Correct.
Correct?
100%.
Okay. But the reality is what the reality is. Okay? This isn't a children's story. This is reality.
Right.
And real life is that the majority of the universities and colleges out there are cheating in some form or fashion.
Right.
Okay. So from that point of view, yeah, you're saying you're letting your fandom come in, but if everyone's doing it, that means not the excuse of, well, they're doing it. No. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is it's part of the culture. Like, it's part of the fabric of college athletics. Now, in certain places, it may not occur as much, or you may not know of it, but it's going on.
Okay. And that's what I'm trying to get at. Be more like those places. If this is the way it is, and I'm going to assume that neither myself nor Raymond can do anything about it.
Correct.
Then you just have to be smart. That's why I'm not going to call Will Wade cocky or arrogant for getting caught, but I'm going to call him comfortable. I think because that
short-sighted.
Is...
Short-sighted.
Yeah.
Short-sighted. For someone who's as intelligent as he is.
And maybe because he never coached in the era of college hoops where this wasn't as prevalent.
Possibly. I think for his, for me, for him, it's the company that you keep. And you make the statement at SEC Media Day, I never did any business with Christian Dawkins. And then we have the wiretap conversations via the FBI. Look, if you're going to do this, then do it so well that the FBI isn't wiretapping you. Like that's my thing. That for a guy that is immensely intelligent, I don't care that he's arrogant. I don't. I absolutely do not care that he's arrogant whatsoever. That does not bother me. I don't need my coaches to be cuddly and friendly. I don't need them to give me a hug. Okay? The coach of my football team
right.
in Tuscaloosa is not a teddy bear. No. Okay? He's not. And I like him being that way because he gets results, okay? Sometimes you can be Dabo Sweeney and be a big hugger and a smiler and everything and get results, and sometimes you're not. So I don't care. I don't care about the personality. I know Will Wade rubs people the wrong way. I know Will Wade rubs people the wrong way here in Acadiana because of what happened between him and the Raging Cajuns and the NIT. I understand that. I get that. I can respect that. But I don't care. It does not affect me personally.
Right.
I don't need coaches to be lovable. I don't need them to be personable. It makes my job easier when they are, but I don't need them to be. That's not a requirement. That's not part of their job description. Mm-hmm. Their job description is to win.
Greg Popovich. See Greg Popovich.
Yes, and when there's a culture between these sneaker companies and these low-level middlemen and these agents, this is the playing field. This is what it is.
Right.
So, excuse me. So why not change it? Like, why not fundamentally change it? You've heard people like Jay Billis for years has proposed, why not create a stipend of some kind where a player will get paid once they leave? So you get paid so much money, right? So let's say you're Cody Schutz, you're a second baseman, and you're going to LSU, and then LSU can say, okay, Cody, well, this is the deal. You're getting a scholarship, but on top of that, we're going to pay you $3,500 per year that you stay with the program, and once you leave the program, whether you graduate, then you get this money. It's like a trust.
Yeah. If I stay 3 years, I leave with
and you'll get a bonus for graduating.
Right.
That's how I would do it. I'd say, hey, there's an incentive. If you decide to graduate, you get this other bonus.
Right.
And then you can get the money after you leave. Why not change it? Because right now, corruption has run rampant in college athletics for generations. It hasn't got better. It's gotten worse. So if we keep attacking it and trying to deal with it being reactionary, well, oh, we found this investigation. Now we have to strip that person, that team, that program of a Final Four trip. Bruh, they've been stripping postseason tournaments for teams for two generations now, and it hasn't stopped.
My argument.
Sorry, it just hasn't.
My argument to that is, hey, did Reggie Bush ever win the Heisman Trophy?
He sure did.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, like that, and it's the stupidest thing. That's an NCAA thing. Yeah. It's the stupidest thing. We're going to strip you of victories. Yeah. It's like with the Raging Cajuns. Oh, we're going to strip them of the two New Orleans Bowl victories and a lot of those other wins, and we're just going to make it more difficult for the Sports Information Department when they're having to put out data about those seasons because they have to put the little asterisks everywhere.
Right.
I remember watching those games. I remember watching them win those games. So you can't take that away from me. I remember the Fab Five of Michigan playing for the national championship.
Taylor Rose is still on TV. Like,
right. Like
I see him all the time.
And unless you're going to go in and do a Men in Black mind wipe.
Flashy thing.
A little flashy thing.
Let me ask you this.
Stupid.
Let me ask you this. Since I'm already kind of in this segment, I'm teetering on opinions that probably aren't as popular. The take is that if you're going to start paying college athletes while they're in school, okay, not your stipend idea that you were saying how when they leave you pay them and this and that. If you're going to give them some sort of money while they're in school, I've always heard the argument that, well, the starting quarterback on the football team needs the same as the backup left, back on the soccer team.
No.
Why?
No.
Why?
Because the quarterback means more.
I
hate to be that way.
But that's what I'm trying to say. I agree with you. But the argument I always hear is that the quarterback and the second string defender on the soccer team should get the same stipend.
No,
I don't agree with that. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't agree with that.
For even farther, the
starting quarterback on the football team should probably get a little higher of a stipend than the punter on the same football team.
Correct, because
you maybe can't split it between starting quarterback and backup quarterback. That would start to get a little tough because one injury now all of a sudden he is your starter. So that's where. But I mean,
tiered.
It could be, but you understand what I'm saying. I don't subscribe to the theory or to the train of thought that every college athlete, if we're going to pay them, all should get a flat rate.
No.
I disagree. Shouldn't. I disagree with that.
If you're going to go with that proposal, football is going to be king and then basketball right behind it.
Because I think it should go university by university. Because LSU, baseball players would get more than basketball at LSU. That makes more money for the university, I think. I'm not looking at any numbers, but I would bet.
Right.
Attendance-wise, and then postseason play.
And probably at Duke, the basketball team should get more than the football team.
Right. Zion Williamson should have made more than Daniel Jones.
Right. And here's the thing, and I think that's the huge disconnect, too.
I don't know if you can do that, though.
There's a lot of outrage about this, but fans don't seem to care. Right? I mean, that's the thing. The people that are spending the money buying the merchandise from their favorite college athletic teams or programs, they don't seem to care. They don't care that there's illegal recruiting going on.
Free Will Wade shirts were a thing.
Yes. I mean, think about it this way. Before you were born, what year were you born? 1990?
Established 1990.
Established 1990. I love that. Established 1990. I'm established 1978, then I'm going to start doing that.
Oh, by the way, happy birthday to the father-in-law, Todd. Happy birthday to you. Turning the big 5-0 today.
Happy birthday to Todd.
Yeah.
Give him the shout-out. A little RP3 shout-out. I'm sure he won't care that I gave him the shout-out. Pony Excess, the great 30 for 30 about SMU.
Yeah, the basketball, right? The death.
No, the football.
Football, the death penalty, right?
Eric Dickerson, okay? Craig James, all these guys. That was going on there in the late 70s, early 80s. It is 2019 now. Nothing's changed. SMU got the death penalty. It didn't change. Yeah, you understand what I'm saying here? Like, we want to believe, oh, this is the moral thing to do, and this is the moral high ground. We should do this. Guys, it was even SMU. That occurred in the 80s. It's 2019. And we're still having discussions about the recruitment of players and players being paid. It's never going to go away. There's never going to be anything that the NCAA can do, whether it's the death penalty or the threat of the death penalty or stripping away victories or taking away titles and making banners come down out of the rafters, any of that stuff that they've done over and over and over again, scholarship reductions, it does not matter. It just doesn't matter. It's going to continue to happen. There's going to continue to be boosters. There's going to continue to be shady middlemen. That stuff's always going to exist until the NCAA changes their mindset, their way of thinking, and going, you know what? We've tried to fight this battle for so long. How can we regulate it? It's like prohibition. Oh, we're going to ban alcohol. That didn't work. Made it worse.
Yeah. The answer to that may be that the NCAA is not the body to regulate this.
They sure don't seem like they're capable.
And I don't know if, I mean, that is, we're talking about at this point, like an XFL type of announcement that, whoa, there's a whole nother league now type of thing, but even on a grander scale, because the NCAA right now, it would be like, you know, it's almost too big to change now. It's like if McDonald's decided tomorrow that, now scrap that, we're going to seafood. Like, I don't think they could pull that off. I don't think you could do that. And I think the NCAA would be, in a similar sense, it'd be such a drastic change that I don't know if they could pull it off. Like FIFA. FIFA's the same way. You know, you try to get
riddled with corruption.
You try to get rid of one person in FIFA, that doesn't change. That doesn't make any difference. No, the whole body needs to be revamped, gotten rid of, whatever the case is. So I don't know.
Why not make it easier? Why not try to regulate it and control it more? It's not going to be that hard to create that stipend system. I'm a big fan of that. I think it makes sense. I think it makes the best sense, and you'll have guys not be so inclined to leave because they'll know they'll have some money when they do leave.
Right.
And you're also going to help with that thing of how many underclassmen did we have that did not get drafted for the NFL draft this year, and it happens with the NBA all the time. Now you give a little bit more of an incentive of, hey, you can ask about what that agent's going to do or whatever that's going to do, but you can come back. You got this money that you're going to get once you leave. Why not set it up? Because at the end of the day, these NCAA programs are feeders for the pros. They are.
I still have so many questions. I still, because we don't have enough time to get into it, because it's one of those where, no, UL couldn't pay their starting quarterback as much as LSU or Oklahoma or TCU could pay their starting quarterback with a stipend thing. But it's like, oh, does that make the playing field unfair because LSU can get the better players because they can make their stipend larger?
UL's not getting the same players
is
that LSU's getting
anyway. That's kind of my argument there is, was that quarterback ever going to go to UL in the first place? No. And I'm just picking UL and LSU because that's where I'm sitting at right now.
No.
It can be Oklahoma and, Oklahoma State. It doesn't matter. It can be TCU and Texas. There's a disconnect there. It doesn't matter what the schools are. I have so many questions. I need more hours. What's frustrating is that no matter how many hours you take, we won't ever have an actual answer. We'll have ideas. We'll have theories, but no answers.
I feel like that's a challenge. I'm going to put that on my itinerary right behind starting a heckling group to bother you while you're coaching T-ball.
Does that come before or after the cure for cancer?
I may have to put the T-ball heckling number one on that list. Just saying. We got to hit a break here at RP3 and Company. You're listening to 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. Simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Network. Want to touch on NBA playoffs. First round of both the Western Conference and Eastern Conference postseason was a bit dull, to say the least. The Warriors were tested a little bit. They're always intriguing to me. Obviously, that Nuggets-Spurs series was really interesting. That went 7 games. Spurs let the Nuggets off there. And you thought, heading into the second round, it's all about these second-round matchups, the conference semifinals. Milwaukee, Boston in the East, Philly and Toronto. Those are going to be two intriguing series that should go 6 to 7 games. The Western Conference, Golden State versus Houston. And then the other game, the kind of lost matchup, is Portland versus Denver. And Denver had to go 7 games, the 2 seed, to get rid of San Antonio, the 7 seed in the opening round. And Portland's coming off that terrific victory over Oklahoma City, where Dame Lillard hits that 37-foot three-pointer, takes them out. But Denver took care of business in the opening round in Game 1, 121-113. They lead that series now 1-0. Should be interesting. I could see that series going 7 games. I think that's going to be a back-and-forth series. And also in the Eastern Conference, Philly got back on track, but based on Jimmy Butler dropping 30 points, helping the 76ers even up that series 1-1 with the Raptors 94-89. So NBA playoffs are starting to get ranked, riled up, so to speak, here in the conference semifinals. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Dale Seurat, head coach of Notre Dame softball. They're state champions right here on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company. I'm your host, Raymond Parch III, here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. We're also simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Network, 24 Hours Sports. It's time to welcome on our next guest live right here in the 237 Roof Studios. At 36 years old, he just became a state champion in his first season at Notre Dame High School. After formerly coaching the baseball team at Mamou High School, his alma mater, and spending a year on the staff at McNeese State as an assistant coach, a student assistant coach with the softball program, he took over a Notre Dame team that had 7 seniors graduate and 1 player transfer from last year's state championship team. Despite that, he helped guide the Lady Pios to a 32-0 regular season mark and then marched through the Division III bracket on their way of defeating Menard 7-3 in the state championship game to be crowned once again state champions. It's our privilege to welcome onto the show Dale Seurat, head coach of the Notre Dame softball team. Coach, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great. I appreciate y'all having me here.
Oh, we appreciate you making some time for us. I know it's been a time to celebrate, especially after taking care of business there in Sulphur over the weekend. Let's start there, Coach. You enter the playoff bracket as the 1 seed. You received a first-round bye, and then you just kind of marched through 14-0 against Ascension Episcopal. Then it was 15-0 against Riverside, and a little bit more competition in the state championship game. But you guys do get the 4-run win victory. Talk a little bit about what it was like for you guys in the postseason, marching through and getting that state championship.
Yeah, we were able to get a bye as a 1 seed, so there was a little sitting period where, you know, in the select division you have a bye, so you take a week off. So we played an exhibition game against John Curtis just to stay sharp, just so we can continue. You know, continue working on some things. Our first opponent was Ascension Episcopal. We played pretty well that game and were able to, you know, have a shutout, and our pitcher threw really well. And then we went on to Sulphur and faced Riverside. We'd played them before in the season, so we had a pretty good idea what we'd see from them. And then we played a pretty, really good Menard team, well-coached, great pitcher, good staff. So we knew we'd be in a dogfight there.
How did it feel when you guys were able to hoist the state championship trophy and you were able to bring that back home to Crowley?
It was a phenomenal feeling. I was excited for our girls. They've worked extremely hard, relentless. It's been a long season. We started actually since August with some of these girls, so it was pushing close to 6 months of just, you know, hitting and working and fielding. So I was excited for them. They deserved all the praise.
Did you have any thoughts whatsoever that this team could go undefeated during the regular season. I mean, you guys didn't drop a game the whole year. That's such a rare feat, especially in softball here in the state of Louisiana. Did you have any idea that your team was going to be that talented and that you guys weren't going to lose a game?
Well, I knew we would be good. I saw that early on in practice. You know, if we worked really hard, we can be really good. You have to expect some adversity, a few humps during the season. But I knew we had a good chance to beat everybody we played, regardless of who we played. So as we kept winning, I kept seeing that, you know, it was 5-0 and then 10-0 and then 12, and then it just kept moving on. So somewhere midway through the season, we felt like we could do it. And the girls were, they wanted to protect it.
We're talking to Coach Del Seurat, first-year head coach there at Notre Dame High School, in charge of the softball program. Coach, let's talk a little bit about when you decide to take this job. Ashley Ray left. She had won a state championship there as the head coach last year. She goes on to Southside High School. You get hired on. Walk me through that process. You know, you were a former baseball coach. You played baseball in high school. Now you had the 1 year of being a student assistant at McNeese. What made you want to get into coaching softball?
My daughter started playing softball, and that's really what got me interested in playing in coaching softball. It really was, they needed a coach at the time. I was a baseball coach, so they just needed a coach to step in and coach. So that's really when I started to fall in love with it. And then I coached some travel ball.
Okay.
So that, you know, that kept me interested. The actual transition to Notre Dame happened. It's all about family. I wanted to see my family a lot more. College is real taxing, you know, on your body and, you know, on your family, not seeing them. So when the position came open at Notre Dame, I thought it would have been the best fit for not only me, but for my family.
So you just pounced on it as soon as it opened up. You were ready to get back to high school.
Absolutely.
Now, Coach, you apply for the job. You go through the process. They hire you. You know, you have the experience of coaching in college a little bit. You've coached your daughter. You coach travel ball. But you're taking over a program with high expectations. They're coming off a Division III state championship. And on top of that, you lost 7 seniors to graduation and an 8th player transferred out. So not only are you dealing with high expectations of a state championship winning program, you have to do a rebuild or a reboot on the fly, and yet you are able to go undefeated and win another state championship. Any trepidation whatsoever when you took over the job? You knew it was going to be a good opportunity, but did you think, oh, wow, I got my work cut out for me here as a first-time, first-year head coach of a softball program?
Well, the administration and the school never, you know, they never pressured me into anything state championship-wise, anything. I just wanted us to put a solid team on the field, have some girls that would work real hard. So our school, I credit our volleyball team more than anything because –
Really?
Yeah, they do a really good job of getting the girls physically and mentally in shape. So when I get them, we whip them in a softball shape. They're physically in shape. Mm. So overall, we our expectations were to work hard and put a solid team on the field, and that's what I think we've accomplished this year.
Was there a turning point, or maybe not a turning point because you guys were so dominant, especially if you look at the run differential we were trying to look at, me and Cody the other day, and we're like, there's a lot of 15-0 games in that in that stretch. But was there a point during the season where you're like, this team, despite having a lot of younger players being forced to step up, boy, we have something special here. Like, we could make it to Sulphur, and we could possibly win a state championship. Was there a moment during the season that you kind of had that revelation?
Absolutely. It was actually after we played in our Lutcher tournament. First time I ever told the girls, we talked after the tournament, and I told them, I said, we're really good. When we're doing things right, we're really good. We have a chance to do something really special. First time we talked about it, really talked about it in depth. But we still had a lot to work on. We still had a lot of small things to work on. We're 29 games into the season, 29-0, and we're still talking about field maintenance and, you know, taking ownership and cleaning up around the park. So there was a lot of little things that we had to do that I felt would transpire over into the field.
What is your coaching style?
I try to create an environment where kids having a male staff to where our girls are never intimidated by our coaches. I want them to understand that, you know, that we set a good example for them as men, and that they know their own identity, because we are spending the most time with them. So, you know, the foundation that we lay out could be their next husband, their next boyfriend,
right,
the next thing. So we try to make sure that they're always comfortable, that they're playing within themselves, they're playing fast, they're playing, and they're having fun.
What has it meant to you, or maybe what has it meant to the bond that you have with your daughter, being able to coach girls at the high school level and coach and win a state championship? That must be something great for you and your daughter, because she's the one that kind of got you into softball, mm-hmm. coaching softball to begin with. What's that been like, and, you know, how it basically came with wanting to spend more time with your daughter to now you're a state championship yeah. winning coach. What's that for meant
well,
to you?
The funny thing is I have none of my daughters play softball anymore. So they're cheerleaders and dancers.
Okay.
So that kind of turned me for a little spin. I have a son that plays baseball, and okay. and last year when I was at McNeese, I missed a lot of his games. So my wife did a lot of the duties. You know,
right.
she ran around. So it was about seeing him. You know, seeing him play a lot more. So actually, my daughters now I get to see them dance and recitals. I actually have a recital this weekend. So. That's ultimately what turned it.
I've been there. I have a daughter too, so it's recitals. But now I've got her getting into karate, so she's all about knocking those little boys in the class on their butts, man. Let me tell you, she loves doing that. What did you learn? You know, you kind of hinted at it here, Coach, and we're talking to Dale Sarathi. He's the head softball coach at Notre Dame High School, Division III state champions over the weekend. What did you learn during that time? I know that it was maybe a little taxing on you, the grind of being an assistant coach there at McNeese State. It takes away time from your family, which I know is important to you, Coach. But what did you learn as a coach during that 1 year as a student assistant with the Cowboys?
One, I learned time management, practice planning. Our head coach, James Langeneau at McNeese, is the hardest working coach I've ever been around. He works extremely hard. So I learned just multiple things. I've learned communication with coaches. I've learned, you know, how to respect your opponents. I've learned to teach the game to our young ladies the way it should be taught.
Tell me a little bit about the makeup of this team. What's the identity of this year's team that went undefeated? Obviously, you guys can score runs in bunches, and you had a lot of new starters. Who are some of the girls that really stood stood up, so to speak, and took leadership roles on this year's team and helped you guys win that state championship?
Well, we had four seniors this year. One was injured prior to the season, so she was unfortunate. She wasn't able to play. We had Sydney Simon, which was our pitcher. She led us in the circle throughout the year. Haley Malaz was our second baseman as a senior, and Mackenzie Abshire was our center fielder. What those three have done for this team as three seniors, it's been remarkable. So they've led. I've went to them with so much stuff about, you know, just handling our girls. Sometimes communication from them was better than coming from me. And then we had a truckload of freshmen that stepped up. We have two sophomores that started at short and third base, Morgan Alamon and Jill Bourgeois. And we had five freshmen in our hitting lineup. You know, Macy Bergeron is our catcher. She's a committed catcher to LSU.
Right.
Abigail Savoie is a committed first baseman to LSU as a freshman. We had right fielder Maddie Merle, Natalie Brown in left field, Kaylin Henry in left field. They split some duties there. So, you know, those freshmen were asked to step up pretty quick.
And Coach, we'll wrap it up with this. Expectations now, though, congratulations, undefeated season, state championship. But now them folks over in Crowley may be a little spoiled there, man, because now that you just had an undefeated regular season and a state championship, so now they're going to be expecting that moving forward. But it seems like maybe you're up to that task, right? You're up to that challenge of keeping that standard as high as it is?
No, absolutely. We started our scheduling for next season yesterday, and we scheduled two state champions right off the bat. So we're gonna push. We're gonna look for competition, and we were blessed. We're fortunate. We thank the good Lord that we were able to have a season, because it's tough, you know, to go undefeated the entire season. And that may never happen again. But our goal will stay in mind. We do want to be in Sulphur and hosting the state championship trophy at the end of the season, every season.
Well, Coach, I appreciate you making some time for us, and congratulations on the terrific job that you did with the Lady Pios this year. And best of luck to you and your team moving forward.
I appreciate y'all having me.
That's Notre Dame head softball coach Dale Seurat, state champion, undefeated regular season there for the Lady Pios. More RP3 and Company coming up after this break right here on 103.7 The Game.
Would be the entrance theme for one former eater of worlds, Bray Wyatt.
Bray Wyatt.
Yes, I don't know. I really hope this is still his entrance theme, because it's one of the best entrance themes, not just music-wise. It's actually just a well-written song. It's well-played. But the entrance, all the lights drop when he comes in. It's sort of an Undertaker deal. All the lights are off in the arena when he makes his entrance. And everyone takes their cell phone, and they do the whole flashlight thing.
Back in the day, it used to be a lighter.
Right, exactly. Same exact thing. These are called, those are the fireflies. That's what it always has been. The fans, his followers, they're the fireflies.
Okay.
We talked last week about Bray Wyatt, and he made his return to WWE after being injured and out for a while. And he made his return in a weird way with the Firefly Funhouse, which is a mishmash of Blues Clues,
Mr. Rogers,
and Pee Wee Herman.
On acid.
Exactly. Yeah, more.
That's what Pee Wee's was.
On more than just that. I don't know what they're on. We had a second episode, because that's what they're called. These are episodes of Firefly Funhouse. They're not just.
Genius.
Yes, it is
genius.
So good. He opened it up, Bray Wyatt did, painting a picture. You couldn't see the picture he was painting. Talking to his audience, which is a bunch of small children. It's just canned laughter, but it's really good.
Yeah.
He goes through a whole spiel, and he's, you know, welcome friends, and he does this whole thing. You got to watch it. It's great. Two major takeaways from episode two of the Firefly Funhouse. The painting, when Bray Wyatt was finished, he showed it to the children and to the camera. It was some sort of old-style house or barn or something engulfed in terrifying flames. I'm not sure how to feel about that. So that's one thing. He's showing this to children.
It fits
you.
The character, though.
It does. The second and more jarring of the two.
Evil Pied Piper kind of thing.
It is a very Pied Piper type thing. Yes, it is. What is it? A Slender Man is the new Pied Piper. If you're a millennial, you'll know that Slender Man is the new guy that takes kids. If you're a Pokemon fan, Hypno, that would be the Pokemon.
But the WWE needs this.
They do.
They need something that's weird. And is kind of eerie and kind of scary. You don't have Undertaker and Kane anymore,
and
right?
And here's what made this go from this guy's. Oh, and they also had a word of the day on. and the word of the day was sociopath. So how's that? He spelled it. He's like S-O-C-O-I-A-T. It was great. But the biggest thing I got was at the end. Bray Wyatt. He's got a new catchphrase, I guess. His catchphrase used to be "Follow the buzzards,"
right?
Or "I've got the whole world in my hands." Those were his kind of things. Now his catchphrase seems to be, I'll light the way. All you have to do is let me in. He ended the episode yesterday, and I'm going to try to do it justice by it was basically like this. Well, thanks for joining me today, kids, on this episode of Firefly Funhouse. It's been wonderful, and always remember, I'll light the way. All you have to do is let me in. Bye. Thanks for hanging out today, guys. Have a wonderful time. Bye.
I love the creepy, insane.
I cried.
It's absolutely a personality, and that's.
I got the chills right now.
And that's been my. We've had this conversation with the old school wrestlers. The gimmicks. I always felt that they were better because they were weird and they would be out there, and it'd be over the top.
IRS. case in point.
$1 Million Man Ted DiBiase. Yeah. Okay, Jake the Snake Roberts, any of those guys. in wrestling, even though the guys are more fit, better athletes, the men and the women.
Right, absolutely.
They're far better wrestlers now than they were, say, 20, 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
by far.
Mm-hmm.
Lacks personality. Not a knock on Roman Reigns. What?
Roman Reigns, AJ Styles, and even John Cena to a certain extent. John Cena he came in at the end of that era where there were characters, and he had the Doctor of Thuganomics, but then he kind of transitioned to a Roman Reigns, AJ Styles, Finn Balor. All of those guys, their gimmicks are, hey, I'm a wrestler.
Right.
And that's kind of boring. It's fine. It works because, you know, where's Stone Cold Steve Austin?
You can have those guys. There's nothing wrong with having
those
guys.
Because that's what Hulk Hogan was. Hulk Hogan's gimmick was, I'm a wrestler.
Right.
And
not
it worked.
A great one.
No, well, that's irrelevant. The gimmick was great, but the wrestling was not.
But you have to have the balance. And I felt like the WWE's gone in this direction where it's been too much of that. Not enough characters. The Undertaker's not there anymore. Kane's not there anymore. Mankind. You had those guys, Mick Foley. Right. You had those guys that balanced it out, right? You had your characters and you had the guys that are wrestlers. And now it's just wrestlers. And it's a little bland. So I love the fact that they have this former character guy coming back off injury as a demented children's show host with buzzards and a demented little doll. Is that going to be a person? We don't really know. Okay. And he's like crazy Bob Ross paintings of fire.
Great.
Like, great.
The
that,
point
that
is, stay tuned.
Me.
Yes, exactly.
Like, it's theater and it's intriguing and it's a hook and it gives it some depth.
It's thought-provoking. It's good.
I'm on board.
Yes!
I'm on board. Second hour in the books here on RP3 and Company. When we come back, we'll lead off the third hour talking to Nick Suss of the Clarion Ledger. He's going to give us a preview of the Ole Miss LSU baseball series right here on 103.7 The Game.
Live and local, we are Acadiana Sports Station. 103.7 The Game. KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parch III and Cody Schutz talk sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. LSU All-American Skylar Green.
You know, as a young athlete growing up, you always want to do the game-winning something, the game-winning shot, game-winning catch. And I thought the biggest part for me right there, that Georgia catch, that solidified everybody seeing that LSU for real.
Ridge and Cajun hoop star Elfrid Payton.
But it's definitely a boost for you, you know, when you look up in the stands and you see your mom, see your dad, night in and night out, it's just different. I encourage everybody to be an opportunity to play at home, to do it. It's very fulfilling.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Third and final hour of RP3 and Company has arrived here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live, as always, from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. Simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Network, 24-hour sports network. You can give us a call if you'd like on the ARCO Equipment Hotline here in this final hour, 337-706-0111. 337-706-0111. Terrific start to the day. We focused a lot on the Will Wade situation being mentioned in court once again by a convicted felon. Talked about that heavy in the first hour. Also talked about Raging Cajun's Tony Robichaux discussing what his team needs to do to get back on track and the things that have held them up from achieving success as the Raging Cajuns are 20-27 overall. We also touched on a little wrestling talk, which was fun, as always. A little NBA playoffs. And we had a terrific first guest to the day in Dale Seurat, first-year head coach at Notre Dame High School. His team went undefeated during the regular season and brought home the Division III state championship from Sulphur this past weekend. So we thank him for coming in studio and joining us live right here. Reminder, LSU baseball is going to be at home this weekend, taking on the Ole Miss Rebels. That's right.
Hotty toddy.
The Rebels come to town, and It's a three-game set. You can listen to it live right here on 103.7 The Game. Friday, Ben Love, the good brother, host of Bumper to Bumper Sports, will be live from Orfino's from 4 to 6:30. He's going to lead you in to LSU pregame at 6:30. First pitch at 7 right here on 103.7 The Game. Then Saturday, we got something special lined up for you. We'll have live coverage of the Kentucky Derby on Saturday. That'll be from 4 to 6 o'clock via our friends at Westwood One. And then we'll switch over to LSU pregame at 6 o'clock. First pitch, 6:30 on Saturday.
So run that down for me one more time. Because Saturday, that's a busy day. That's a lot happening. Yes. That's a lot of moving parts.
That is a busy day. The debut episode of our new show, Under the Dome, with CD.
It gets even bigger on Saturday.
From 10 to 12. And then we'll have Kentucky Derby coverage, pre-race coverage, as well as the actual race via Westwood One at 4 to 6. And then LSU versus Ole Miss pregame at 6. First pitch, 6:30. Also, on Sunday, we'll wrap up the three-game set with LSU versus Ole Miss pregame at 2 o'clock, first pitch at 2:30. So you can just keep it live and local right here on 103.7 The Game for all your LSU coverage this coming weekend. And the Tigers, I have a good one. Look, Ole Miss is a good ball club. They're trending in the right direction.
30 and 15 overall. They're to that 30-win mark already.
30 and 15. They are a good ball club. And, you know, what has LSU done in recent weeks? You know, they struggled with Alabama. They struggled to put away Bama. Nothing. You can't feel immensely confident coming out of that Alabama series when Ole Miss comes to town. At least I wouldn't. You know, there's still questions that have to be asked. Is Zach Hess going to be part of the lineup? We don't know. I mean, part of the rotation, rather. We don't know. Is Mikhail Hilliard going to be part in there? Is Henry going to be healthy enough to take on that Friday night role that Paul Menary wanted to do last week? Remember, Paul Menary, longtime LSU head baseball coach, wanted to make that switch over Henry, the Friday night starter, Eric Walker, your Saturday guy, and then a hodgepodge of maybe Marceau, whoever may be on Sunday. And then Zach Hess was going to go to the bullpen. But then Henry got hurt. Or not hurt, is a little banged up with soreness, yeah. The arm soreness. So what do? So they have to go back to Zach. Zach gets roughed up in the Friday night game against Alabama. The Tide take the first game, but then things settled down. Eric Walker looked good. That may have been the best he's looked all year. Is he finally getting to the point now where he's healthy and he's returning to the form? He was powerful. He struck out guys Saturday in Tuscaloosa. That's not his game. He's not a power pitcher. But he looks like he's getting stronger, more confident out there on the bump. He had a good outing from Landon Marceau, the freshman who started off the year as the number two guy in the weekend rotation. He was your Saturday guy. He struggled. Then he got banged up a little bit. So you get a little bit more confidence there with the rest of the rotation. And if Henry is healthy, he was your best pitcher all year. He's been the best pitcher all year. So do they go ahead and make that change for the weekend series against Ole Miss? Do you trot out Henry, a weekend rotation of Henry, Walker, and Marceau, and have Zach be your innings eater out of the bullpen with Peterson and Fondo being out there as well?
I mean, that would seem ideal. That would seem like what you want to do. I just took a minute here because I was curious at Ole Miss's SEC play, because they're 30 and 15 overall,
And they just trucked Texas A&M, who was ranked number 6 at the time.
But they're 13-8 in conference, which is right about where everyone is in conference. So I just wanted to point out, they started their SEC series with Bama. They took 2 out of 3.
Okay.
Then they played Missouri. They lost 2 out of 3.
That sounds familiar.
All right. Then they played Arkansas. This is impressive. They took 2 out of 3 from Arkansas, but possibly that's early enough in the SEC play before Arkansas kind of sustained themselves as one of the better teams. But they did take 2 or 3 from Arkansas. They swept Florida next. And that was when Florida, I mean, they're still struggling, but they did get a good sweep of Florida.
Okay.
Here's an interesting run. They lost 2 out of 3 to Kentucky after that.
Ooh.
They lost 2 out of 3 to Auburn the following weekend. And then after that Auburn series, they played Mississippi State in the midweek in a non-conference game. It's some kind of, it's like a Wally Pontiff Classic. They do something like that with Ole Miss and Mississippi State non-conference. And Ole Miss lost to Mississippi State in that midweek game in the non-conference. But then, just this past weekend, as you said, they swept Texas A&M. So it depends, it seems to me, what Ole Miss team is going to show up at the box.
And that sounds familiar, because we asked that about LSU. Which LSU team is going to show up?
It's just curious to me that they have only, let's see, they've played 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, they've played 8 SEC series. Nope. 7.
And 2 of those were against top 10 teams that they beat.
And they've
swept. But they also lost to Kentucky.
They've won 4 and they've lost 3, but 2 of those 4 they won have been sweeps. So it's like they either, seems like they play extremely well, or they can barely scratch out one victory. I don't know.
I think you could make that argument with the exception of maybe Vanderbilt, that that's what the SEC is this year.
Okay. I mean, that everyone's record seems to be hovering right around 13-8, right, doesn't it?
Right. I think there's so much parity in the SEC this year. If you take Vandy out of the mix, who I think is the best team in the SEC by far, I don't think it's close.
And Georgia's a close second. Maybe not close second. All right,
fair enough.
I'll give it to you.
Yeah, if you watch them play.
Because I'll give it to you because I am the determining factor on all that is college baseball. Ha, ha, ha.
I am the ruler.
Right. Let's see. Overall conference play, Vandy is 15-6, and then that's actually the same exact conference record as Arkansas.
Correct.
Vandy and Arkansas both are 15-6. Mississippi State, Georgia, Ole Miss, and LSU are all hanging out at that 13-8.
All log jam right there.
And then there's a 2-game or so drop.
So and there's only a 2-game difference between Vandy and Arkansas to the rest of the group. It's tied for third. Right?
Right. Vandy and Arkansas are tied for first, and then Mississippi State, Ole Miss, LSU, and Georgia are tied for third or second, however the hell that works.
Well, you skip, yeah.
Right, because there's 2 teams tied for first, you skip second, so all those teams are tied for third.
So, this is a huge series, because the SEC has so much parity this year, even though I feel Vandy's the best team out of the bunch, Arkansas is right there, and look, Ole Miss, Georgia, Mississippi State, LSU are all in striking distance. They're all right there. Okay, so the regular season championship is still in grasp for all of those teams. You don't know what's going to happen when they get to Hoover for the SEC tournament. But this is a big series because if you look at the schedule, they have a couple midweek games left, La Tech, New Orleans. That's not going to be that big of a deal. Both going to be at the box. But Ole Miss this weekend, the next weekend at Arkansas. So right now they're tied for third with Ole Miss. They can separate themselves by taking 2 out of 3 from Ole Miss this weekend at the box. Next weekend they go up, face the leader, tied for the lead in the conference, Arkansas also in the SEC West. Boom. And then one more series after that is at home versus Auburn, who's kind of fading.
Right. And just
so these 2 weekends are big for the regular season championship. Obviously, look, LSU fans, we know it ain't about regular season championships. It's about adding something out to that monster billboard.
It's about tournament championships.
Well, it's about College World Series.
Well, whether that tournament is the SEC, the regional tournament, and then the Super Regional is not really a tournament, but then the College World Series. It's about winning postseason baseball. Another few little stats here that might give you kind of an inkling as to what we could hope to see at the box this weekend. On the road this year, Ole Miss is 7-8. At home, LSU is 23-4.
Oh.
So that sits pretty for the Tigers. The Tigers 23-4 at home and welcoming in a team that is 7-8 on the road. So a team under 500 on the road is coming in.
A team that struggles on the road. and you have an opportunity and you're great at home, you have an opportunity to take a series, maybe even sweep a series, but this time of year it's hard to sweep. So let's say you take two or three, you win the series.
Yep.
You'd have to be favored here, despite the fact that Ole Miss has defeated some quality ball clubs and taken series away from some of the best teams in the SEC.
I mean, it's what it looks like. I mean, LSU, Ole Miss has one more win. Ole Miss is 30-15 overall. LSU is 29-16. They're both 13-8 in conference. I mean, you can't get record-wise much more even than that until you look at their home and road splits. Ole Miss is struggling on the road, which a lot of teams are. If I look, LSU does have the worst road record of any team. They're 6-11 on the road is LSU. That's very poor.
This is why it's key for them to win this series this weekend at the Box versus the Rebels, because they have to go on to the road and take on a very good Arkansas team in Fayetteville. And if they've struggled on the road, thankfully, though, they'll come back after that Arkansas road trip. They'll host UNO in a midweek game and then host Auburn to close it out before SEC tournament time. So maybe they can build up some momentum there. So, yes, big difference, as you said, between being at home and on the road for these teams. But I liked, if they can get their pitching together, LSU, if Henry's going to be the guy followed by Walker and Marceau, and you can have Zach in the bullpen to eat up innings, and Peterson and Fondo, and then you can let Mikhail Hilliard be your midweek guy, they could trend in the right direction here.
I mean, the bats are trending that way.
The bats, the lineup is getting healthy, which is key for them. Dugas contributing out of nowhere, but a healthy Daniel Cabrera, a healthy Zach Watson's making all the difference in the world.
Cade Beloso's finally seeing the ball.
Correct.
Saul Garza seems to be back healthy for the first
lineup,
time this season.
The lineup is trending the right way.
Got to get it right on the bump.
More than just get it right, you need to be more consistent on the bump. Right?
Know what you're going to get.
Because if your lineup knows, look, any baseball team worth their salt knows what their pitcher's weaknesses are.
And that's why I think what Gunner,
back in the day with the Atlanta Braves or with the Cubs, they knew in the back of their mind that they didn't have to score a lot of runs when Greg Maddux took the mound.
Right.
Now, that betrayed Maddux because he lost a lot of games and got a lot of no decisions because his team wouldn't score enough runs. But say if you're the Braves and you have that lineup of Glavin, Smoltz, Steve Avery, and Maddux,
Don't forget John Rocker.
John Rocker was a closer. But you know when those guys take the field to take the bump, you're probably going to have to score more runs for Steve Avery. They know that. Like you understand what I'm saying? Like the guys know, hey, this is our guy, but we got to step up for him. We got to make sure to take care of something for him. So we need to make sure to score more runs. They can tell you all they want that they don't think that way, but they know this is the team dynamic.
That's
and how
any
this
level
works.
Of baseball, I feel, right?
Right, this is how this works. So this is what they'll do. So if they know that one of these guys they have to score a little bit more runs for, they can adapt to that and do that. That's why you need the consistency. Right. You don't need these guys to be great. We don't need them to be Alex Lyon. Okay, you just don't. You don't. You just need them to be consistent. And if they can be just good and consistent, LSU can win it all. They have the lineup to do that. They just need the pitching staff and the bullpen just to be good. They don't have to be great, just be good and consistent, and that's all they need.
Hoorah.
Hoorah! When we come back here on RP3 and Company, we'll discuss a little Houston Astros baseball right here on 103.7 The Game. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards has proclaimed the month of April as Safe Digging Month in Louisiana as part of a nationwide safety awareness campaign to draw attention to the importance of safe digging. In Louisiana, there are thousands of miles of utility lines and gas pipelines buried just beneath the surface. So if you or a contractor that you've hired is digging a hole to put in a new fence, a pool, or even a garden, you run the risk of hitting an underground line even by digging only a few inches. That's why it's so important for everyone to dial 811 and call Louisiana One Call 2 days before they dig. You just tell the operator your address and someone will come out and mark the location of buried lines so you or your contractor can avoid them. It's simple, it's free, and it's the law. all diggers and demolishers are required to notify Louisiana One Call before they begin work. The law applies to individuals as well as contractors, municipalities, and others. Failure to call can subject the individual to fines and liability for damages to buried infrastructure. So call 811 and know what's below before you dig.
Here's a 3-2. This one's belted. Right field. That's that homer. And it's a solo. Twins lead 1-0.
0-2. Ground ball tap weakly right side. Coming on the field at Crone. He's got it. Steps on first. And that is the ball game. Minnesota Twins shut out the Houston Astros. Take game one of this four-game series as Minnesota wins it 1-0.
Welcome back to RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game. I am your host, Raymond Parch III. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. Simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Network. 24-hour sports news for your enjoyment. Plus, you get to see me on television. So, I mean, that's a win-win for everyone.
They also, on the weekends, they air ROH, Ring of Honor Wrestling.
Nice.
I believe it's like Saturdays at noon or something like that.
Nice. Talked a little baseball in the last segment. LSU, Ole Miss, gave you a brief preview on that. We'll talk more about that throughout the week. Last night, though, the Astros suffered a 1-0 loss. Held to only 5 hits and 0 runs. The Twins had an excellent pitching performance from Jake Odorizzi. And got
yes.
That's what we're going to go with.
It was one of those few times. Like, usually between the two of us, we can come, but I'm going to say yes.
Yes. And got 2 solid innings from the bullpen.
Why don't you tell me who hit the home run for the Twins, too?
Please not. Please,
go
please
ahead.
Don't.
Take a shot at it.
Ari Andrazina?
Yari Adrianza? I don't.
Mash them together so and you got the name.
It'd be funnier if we were doing this on purpose, but that's not.
It was an old-fashioned pitcher's duel, though, there at Target Field in Minneapolis as the Astros are on the road trip opening the first game of this series with the Twins. It was a Verlander pitched really well. I mean, he really well. They matched zeros for most of the game, both going 7 strong innings. The Twins pitcher put up 7 goose eggs. Verlander did have 1 blemish on the outing, coming on that 1 home run. That proved to be enough for the Twins to take down the Astros. But the Twins are pesky, man, right? I mean, they're giving the Astros some fits here. But the 29-year-old for the Twins, he set down 13 straight batters during this game. And he did it well, mixing and matching his fastball with a split finger and a slider. So the Astros will look to get back on track tonight as it's going to be game 2 of this series. And you can listen to that game live right here on 103.7 The Game. Oh, that's right.
6:40 start time.
Oh, that's right. The good brother, Ben Love, will be back in studio. He'll be taking it from 4 to 6:05. And then Astros will take over at 6:05 to 10 o'clock. So Ben Love will have you to Astros pregame. Then Astros pregame will take over. And then Astros at Twins tonight on 103.7 The Game. And that'll be followed after that completion of that game. You can listen to Tiger Rag Radio. That'll come online here on 103.7 The Game afterwards. So a lot of great live and local coverage for you today here on 103.7 The Game. When we come back here on RP3 and Company, our good friend Andrew Juge of the Saints Happy Hour podcast going to help us break down the Saints draft right after this break. Welcome back to RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. Simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Network. It's time now for us to head out to the ARCO Equipment Hotline and welcome on our next guest. He is the man with the Saints Happy Hour podcast. He's our good friend, Andrew Juge. Andrew, how are you this morning, brother?
I'm doing real well. Thanks for having me back.
So tell me how you're feeling, man. How do you feel about the Saints draft strategy, not trading into the first round, trading up in the second, also picking up a fourth round pick? Do you like their picks? Do you like what they did?
Yeah, so listen, I mean, first of all, I've sensed some frustration from Saints fans about the trading up. And at this point, if you're not used to it, if you didn't see this coming, I mean, this is who they are. This is who they are. They go get their guy. That's their draft strategy. And so, honestly, I'm relieved we'll be able to go into the draft next year with a first round pick, because my assumption coming into this was there is a decent chance that they will burn a 2020 pick, a first round pick in 2020. To continue to kind of go all in while they have this window with Drew Brees. So, you know, obviously they burn a 2020 pick, the second round pick, in an effort to move up. But, you know, they get Eric McCoy. And so, you know, it's interesting. I actually had a spreadsheet before the draft, you know, as I like to nerd out and geek out before the draft. And so it was basically a composite aggregate of the scores from NFL.com, Pro Football Focus, ESPN.com, and CBS Sportsline. And so they all have different rankings for the prospects, and my spreadsheet basically takes all those rankings and it puts them together, and then it basically spits out a number for each player. And, you know, they pick McCoy at 48 overall, and the composite aggregate score had him as the 41st ranked prospect. So, they get good value there. I mean, the consensus there among all the talent evaluators is that McCoy is better than where he was selected. And I think that was the consensus that we heard. I mean, as a center, he was one of the best in the draft, and that's not as valued of a position, so it tends to drop. So I think the Saints got good value there. And when you think about losing Max Unger, we kind of overlooked that because he retired and then they signed Nick Easton, but that really was a catastrophic moment in the offseason. Max Unger just so important to this team. And so now you've got Easton and you've got McCoy in the mix. And, you know, I think McCoy will end up being the starter, but you've got a battle there. And I think it gives you just another option to mitigate that loss, which, again, is significant. And then they trade up again. They go get Chauncey Gardner-Johnson, a safety. He was actually picked in the fourth round. The Saints moved up to get him as well. He was 36th on that list, so he was even higher than McCoy. So the value for him was even more significant. And I think really, you know, the draft comes down to those two players. I think everything that happened after that, you know, you're talking about sixth and seventh round picks. Those are guys that are most likely practice squad players. Maybe they make the team, but those are prospects that, you know, will need to be developed over time. And, you know, you don't have too much expectations out of sixth and seventh round picks, but really the two picks in this draft that I think that have a chance to make the team and really contribute in a significant way this year, I thought they were tremendous picks.
We're talking to Andrew Juge of the Saints Happy Hour podcast. Andrew, I want to talk about that position. You know, I feel like McCoy is a plug-and-play starter. He's a guy that was a first-round talent that dropped because – teams put more of a priority on offensive tackles and defensive linemen and linebackers in the first round this year for whatever reason. So they get a great player to fall to them. Now they can have Easton line up at the left guard position. This frees up them to do something with Andres Pete. He can now be the versatile backup at the guard spot or possibly at tackle. They don't have to trade him now. He could possibly play tackle again. Your thoughts on that and what they do with Andres Pete?
I still think Andres Pete is the unquestioned starter at left guard right now. You know, and if you're going left to right, I think at least right now, as of today, and obviously this will need to be sussed out over training camp, over preseason, and injuries can happen, which would dictate maybe changes. But I like Armstead at left tackle, of course, Pete at left guard. I agree with you. I think McCoy is plug and play, so I think that's your center. And then Warford would be the right guard, and obviously Ramczyk at right tackle. So,
but do you really right now, bring in Easton, though, to be a backup? I mean, they didn't sign him to be a backup.
I think so. I think the plan was for him to be a starter until McCoy fell to them at a position where they could go get him, and now that's the battle at center. I don't see Easton unseating. I mean, you have to remember, Easton spent all of last year basically on injured reserve, and so he hasn't been playing. He's maybe going to take this year to be the sixth offensive lineman, the Senio Calamete, if you will, of the Saints.
And with Pete being on contract, right, Andrew? With Andrus being in his last year of his deal, correct? So maybe Easton's also insurance policy correct. If they can't bring back Andrus Pete, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, they currently on the roster, the backup tackles, you've got Derek Newton, you've got Michael Ola. Those are capable players that I think have potential, but the way I see it right now is, you know, with Armstead, he just had so many injuries. You've got to be prepared for something to happen there. If something were to happen early in the season and it wasn't a short-term thing where, yeah, maybe they plug someone in at left tackle and keep on just Pete at left guard because they don't want to shuffle too much. But now I think if something happens to Armstead again, they're more set up to say, you know what, let's go ahead and make that move and kick Andres Pete out there, and then you can plug Easton in at guard. So I think they're going to start the five best players, and, you know, they'll play wherever they need to make it work. But, you know, that'll be an interesting battle. I mean, I think because of the drafting, I mean, obviously McCoy isn't going to be given anything. He's going to have to earn it, but – I do believe that he's a guy, and he's good enough, and he's a good enough prospect that he will earn that starting role at center. Now he'll be battling with Easton, and oh, by the way, I mean, you've got a couple guys in Will Clapp and Cameron Toms who are still interesting prospects and played pretty good in spot duty last year. So all of a sudden, this offensive line is starting to come together, and I think the Saints have done a good job solidifying it. Now you look back to last year. And Raymond, my big thing is, yes, the Saints didn't make the Super Bowl because of a blown call. And you really can just, you can draw the line there. But if you look under the hood a little bit, I think you realize that they really struggled in the playoffs against the Eagles. They really struggled in the playoffs against the Rams offensively. And a big reason for that was how banged up the offensive line was. Really, the second half of the season, it was a problem they were dealing with pretty much all year. Now, obviously, Armstead, we know he's had problems for a long time, and obviously he had another injury. We now know that Max Unger's injuries were so significant that he ended up calling it quits and retired. But it wasn't just him. Andres Pete was dealing with knee issues. He broke his hand. Larry Warford was dealing with knee issues. And Ramczyk was dealing with a myriad of injuries, shoulder, arm, knees. So, you know, they were very, very banged up up front, and these guys are playing at less than 75% in a lot of cases. And so now you've got youthful talent coming in the building. You still like Clapp. You still like Tom. But now you also bring in a rookie center who you think is going to start for you. You bring in Ethan, who gives you insurance. And so I feel like this line is more protected now. If these injuries creep up again, they're going to be in a position to start guys that are capable players.
Andrew, let's talk about the kid out of Florida. He's very versatile, versatile defensive back. He had a grade that was higher than the fourth round. That's another guy that fell down the draft board, and the Saints were able to gobble him up. What kind of role do you see him having with the Saints as a rookie? Is he going to be a special teamer and then maybe a guy that comes in with the dime package or what?
I think that's right, yeah. I think, Chauncey Gardner-Johnson is a really versatile player, a very versatile skill set. He reminds me a little bit of Kenny Vaccaro in what he can do on the field. He can cover the slot. He's got the ability to run with tight ends. And be that nickel corner. Now, right now, I obviously wouldn't put him ahead of P.J. Williams or Patrick Robinson. I mean, those guys are kind of your nickel corners, and I don't necessarily see Gardner Johnson leapfrogging those guys. But if he's on the field at safety, and we know the Saints have employed these three safety packages at times, I think he's got some blitzing ability. He's got some ability to play in the box, and so, you know, Von Bell, eventually he's going to be up for a new contract here. And, you wonder if maybe this is an insurance policy. And we were just talking about Andres Pete and the insurance policy if he were to leave. And, you know, I think the Saints are preparing. Look, they are going to have to pay some big-time contracts coming very soon between Teddy Bridgewater, if they decide they want to keep him long-term, should Drew Brees retire. Cam Jordan is going to be due for a monster deal. Michael Thomas, maybe the richest receiver deal in NFL history. I know that's what he's going to be looking for. Alvin Kamara, Marshawn Lattimore. So they're not going to be able to keep everyone. And when you look at kind of the draft strategy here, it signals to me, and they've already let Kenny Vaccaro walk, it signals to me that the Saints have kind of decided, hey, we're going to have our safeties be on rookie deals for the foreseeable future. We're not going to be investing a bunch in that position. We'll invest draft capital in it, but we're not going to sink money at safety because we've got all these big-time players that we're going to need to pay to retain. So this could be the end for Von Bell. It'll be interesting to see in the offseason what happens there. This offseason, so in free agency, you saw the safety market heat up, and those players were able to get a lot more money than they were the previous offseason where the market for safeties was completely dead. And with that shift, I think the Saints were smart to draft someone that's maybe going to potentially be a strong safety starter for them a year from now.
We're talking to Andrew Juge of the Saints Happy Hour podcast. Let's talk about the young man out of Notre Dame. They talked about tight end being a position of need, having someone young that could be maybe mentored on the roster behind Josh Hill and obviously Jared Cook. What are your thoughts on the young man they took out of Notre Dame, and is he just going to be nothing more than a scout team player, or is he going to be someone that could be a possible number three tight end for this team?
Yeah, I like the selection, to be honest. I mean, I really felt like they had to go into this draft selecting a tight end, at least at some point. And so they get Alize Mack, you know, a guy that I think is – unpolished as a receiver, but has a tremendous amount of potential. And unpolished as a blocker, but has potential there too. So he's got the potential to be a combo tight end that I think is pretty productive. Now, he's one of those guys that I think maybe didn't live up to quite, you know, his capabilities in college. So it's going to be up to the coaching staff to develop him. But when you've got Dan Campbell on your coaching staff, you got to feel pretty good about his ability to turn a young, capable and promising tight end into a good player. So that's going to be up to the Saints. I mean, as I look at this tight end roster, you've got Dan Arnold, you've got Garrett Griffin, and those are really kind of who you're battling with for that third tight end spot. You mentioned, obviously, Jared Cook being signed and Josh Hill being on the roster. Those are kind of your one and two. And so it'll be a good battle for the number three tight end. I mean, I think he'll certainly be in the mix. If he's not able to get that third tight end spot ahead of Dan Arnold or Garrett Griffin, then I think maybe he ends up being a guy that goes on the practice squad in year one. But there is a spot to the roster for him. And so I think as you watch him compete in training camp and preseason, this was a good selection just because the Saints are a little thin and definitely in need of some youthful talent at that position. And so that's a pick where you see, hey, there's a path to making a roster for this guy if he can live up to the expectations. So I like the pick, and hopefully he'll show some things here early in the season.
Andrew, we'll wrap it up with this. You know, a lot of teams will tell you the draft, the foundations for franchises are built from rounds 2 to 5 or 6. That's where the foundation of your franchise, your team is going to come from. But also the Saints have done a tremendous job over the years of signing undrafted rookie free agents that become impact players for them, even if it's just on special teams. Did any one of the guys that they signed stand out to you in particular?
Well, the two running backs, you know, obviously the one from Nebraska has been a big talk. And he's a player that I think Saints fans are excited about. The running back from Kennesaw State is interesting, and he averaged between 9 and 10 yards a carry. He's just an explosive player that you know, was a home run hitter. So, you know, the running back situation is interesting because, again, you look at the Saints and behind Latavius Murray and Alvin Kamara, there's really it's wide open. You've got Washington, who's incumbent and coming back, that was on the roster last year. But I kind of feel like running back is similar to tight end. There's not a ton of depth there, and there's a spot on this roster to be one. And when you look at the Saints' history at running back, I mean, look at all the undrafted guys that have made the team and contributed between Tyree Robinson, Chris Ivory, Pierre Thomas, Treveris Cadet. So there's a long litany of guys, even guys like Lionel Hamilton. So there is a litany of guys that have made this team by impressing in training camp and preseason. So there'll be an opportunity for those undrafted guys. Granderson, the defensive end out of Wyoming, he comes with a very significant character red flag. He'll have a trial coming up later that will determine his innocence or not in a pretty serious case. So we'll see how that plays out. But if he is believed to be, if he becomes innocent and he's a guy that, legal issues get cleared up, he's a guy that should have been drafted and could potentially be a really productive player if he gets cleared. That's one to watch because I do think he has potential, unless and obviously if things don't work out and he's not able to play for the Saints, I mean, they can cut him pretty easily. So it's a very low investment there. And then Will Jordan Humphrey, the receiver out of UCLA, that's another guy that I think Saints fans are excited about. Receiver, I think it's going to be tougher for him to beat out guys like Cam Meredith and Traquan Smith and Keith Kirkwood for a job. But maybe look at him to start on the practice squad and try to develop like Willie Snead or Lance Moore did.
Andrew, appreciate you coming on, breaking down the draft for us, brother. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll talk to you soon, my friend.
That sounds good. Thanks for having me.
It's Andrew Juge of the Saints Happy Hour podcast, breaking down the Saints draft picks.
Just to throw it out there, because if you're like me listening to that, speaking of Carl Granderson, kind of perked your ear up whenever Andrew mentioned it there with it's a sexual assault trial.
Correct.
For posterity's sake, just so we can put it out there for what it is. We'll see how it works out. He has guaranteed himself, Carl Granderson, $70,000 and a $15,000 signing bonus. So he basically made $100,000 no matter what. So
we can discuss.
I'm just reporting the news.
You're just reporting the news. So, yes, we'll see if that's a wasted investment or not by the New Orleans Saints.
Granderson, projected mid-round pick. So somewhere, I guess, between three and five.
Yeah. So, but we thank Andrew for coming on, breaking that down for us. When we come back, we'll put a bow on this edition of RP3 and Company right here on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game, live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. Also, simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1, 24-hour sports network stadium. Programming reminder, our good friend Nick Suss was supposed to be joining us today on the program. Something came up. He will be joining us later in the week, tentatively on Thursday. He's going to help us break down Ole Miss LSU baseball series then, so make sure to tune in on Thursday as Nick will be joining us to do that. I do want to thank our guest today, Andrew Juge of the Saints Happy Hour podcast, for breaking down the Saints draft, as well as Dale Seurat, the first-year head coach of the Notre Dame Lady Pios, who went undefeated during the regular season and claimed the Division III state championship. We got him to sign the big board in here.
Oh, yeah. We got pictures. We got proof.
Proof we had a state champion inside the studio. So thank him for doing that. Programming reminder today. Look, you just keep it right here. Okay? Dan Patrick Show is going to be next, 9 to 11, then followed by the Jim Rome Show from 11 to 2. Then the Jordy Holtberg Show back once again. He returned yesterday. He'll be taking care of you from 2 to 4 today. And then Bumper to Bumper Sports starts at 4. He's going to lead you into Astros at Twins, 6 o'clock. And then after that, Tiger Rag Radio. So just keep it live and local all day here on 103.7 The Game. Before we go, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to have the good guy, the good man himself, Cody Schutz. He's going to throw up a Twitter poll question.
Okay.
Do you think the latest recording is going to cost Will Wade his job? Yes or no? We'll throw that up on the Twitter, 1037 The Game account. You go vote on it. We'll talk about the results on tomorrow's show. We'll give you the full 24 hours to vote, ladies and gentlemen. Full 24 hours. Terrific show. Y'all be safe out there. Enjoy yourself. We'll talk to you tomorrow.